You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of March 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
Today I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
President Barack Obama there revealing his Supreme Court Justice nominee. I'll discuss with my guests James Boyes and Michael Goldfarb why it's become an election issue for the Democrats and the Republicans. And staying in the US, Donald Trump warns of potential riots if he's denied the Republican Party's presidential nomination. Is this a threat to be worried about? Plus, we'll also look at how Cyprus has become a key player in the EU and Turkey's negotiations aimed at stemming the flow of refugees. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are the political historian James Boyes and Michael Goldfarb, author and broadcaster for Politico.eu. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start today, though, with the results of yesterday's Republican and Democratic primaries in the US, where frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump managed to put more distance between themselves and their opponents. Donald Trump won three key primaries, including Florida, and in the Democratic race, Hillary Clinton won comfortably in Florida, Ohio, and Illinois. But today, Trump has raised tensions in an increasingly ugly campaign by warning there could be riots if he's denied the GOP's presidential nomination. James, do we take this seriously, first of all, this? So I guess what he's saying is that he's beginning to sniff that the Republican Party, the grandees, don't want him, and they're holding out for this hope that he won't have enough kind of delegates by the time he comes to the final hurdle, and that they'll manoeuvre him out of the way at the last point. And in a way, he is right to say that would be old politics and something that would upset people.
Well, I'm glad he's come to that realization. I mean, there's no great shock there. What you're implying there, if you're suggesting that old school politics means playing by the rules of the game that everybody knew going into this, then absolutely that's what they're going to have. 1237 is the magical number, and there will be a delegate count when the GOP meet at their convention. And if Donald Trump hasn't reached 1237 on the first delegate count, then all bets are off, and we're into a whole new ball game, quite frankly. And if Donald Trump doesn't like that, then, well, I'm very, very sorry, but that's the rules of the game he promised to abide by, and that's the rules of the game that everybody else is playing by. Now, if he decides that if he doesn't emerge as the GOP candidate, which is not impossible at this point, the big threat he's got, of course, is that he can stage a walkout. He can take his hair, his ego, and his money and walk out of the convention hall with all of his supporters. He would equate to probably about 35-40% of all GOP supporters at this point, and run a spin-off campaign that will just split the vote on the right and deny the White House to whoever the Republican nominee is, and give it to what looks like Hillary Clinton. So he has the nuclear option if he wishes to pursue it. But if he does, all he'll do is guarantee a Democratic victory in November.
But Michael, the trouble for the people at the top of the Republican Party who don't want to see Trump, you know, as their kind of candidate, is that they don't have an alternative, really, do they?
That's not entirely true.
It's not.
In fact, just today, following the results coming in, and even before Trump made his, you know, typically flamboyant, outrageous comment, John Boehner, the former Speaker of the House, who's left political life and has kind of assumed the mantle of a golf-playing, permatanned grandee, said, look, just as James was saying, if he comes to Cleveland and hasn't got the number of delegates he needs to win on the first ballot, then my basic view is none of the above. I've not been impressed by anyone's campaign, and I think that Paul Ryan, who succeeded him as Speaker of the House, would be a very fine presidential candidate, and I will place his name in nomination, and we'll have Paul Ryan as the candidate to stand against Hillary Clinton. And that is entirely possible. Because one of the things that has allowed Trump to reach this point is that there were so many people running,
yeah,
right? And the reason there were so many people running is there's so much money that if you can find a couple of sugar daddies, you can stay in the race even if you're not getting any votes. Now they're all gone except for Ted Cruz, who's actually to the right of Donald Trump and probably even less electable than Donald Trump, and Governor Kasich of Ohio. I imagine that over the next weeks and months, the party will coalesce around Kasich. He may be too far behind to actually catch Trump, or what they'll be hoping is that they can stall Trump so he doesn't get this first round ballot victory. If that happens, then all bets are off. But I do think from what we've seen, and I haven't interviewed him and I haven't had him in my psychiatrist's couch, but he's clearly an egomaniac sociopath, and he perfectly will run off with his delegates.
Even if you believe that's who he is, isn't the real risk here, though, that, you know, there's a huge number of Americans who feel that there is a conspiracy that happens in Washington, that their views are not heard, that there is no way that they can influence what happens in the US, and this would just be proving it to them?
No, absolutely not. I mean, if they believe that, then they are as ignorant as they are portrayed, because quite frankly, the rules of the game were set out and have been in place for forever. I mean, this is no one is trying to orchestrate a situation whereby he doesn't get the nomination. I mean, let's forget, if you go back to 1860, Abraham Lincoln didn't get it on the first ballot, for example. You know, he emerged. He didn't do a bad job, quite frankly. So this idea that somehow there is an attempt to use the rules against Trump is just flawed. The rules of the game are being applied. And at this point, it's unlikely that he's going to get to 1237 going into the nomination. Now, he has every possible opportunity to do so. But what he needs to do moving forward from this point is get about 50% of all the delegates that are available to the GOP candidates from this point onwards. With Rubio dropping out and the potential to coalesce an opposition around Cruz, that just become less and less likely, but it's not impossible.
But don't all of these options just guarantee that Hillary Clinton will be the next president of the United States?
Well, I think that not only do the rules favor that, but also the demographics of the United States favor that. The historic pattern of the United States favors that. People often forget. A lot of people say to me, I'm terrified about Donald Trump becoming president, to which I say, well, hang about a second. The Republicans have only won the popular vote in the United States once since 1988. So the popular demographics of the country, the changing nature of the country, are actually making it more and more difficult for the Republican Party to win the presidency, and therefore more likely that Hillary Clinton will emerge one way or the other as the president in November.
Michael, from outsiders looking into the US, watching this, as you say, it's been gritty, ugly, unpleasant. It shows up many of the divisions within the US. But do you think these divisions are genuinely sharper now than they have been in previous election periods? Yeah. Do you feel, because whoever gets in, it feels like they're going to be kind of, you know, governing half the nation.
The nation's been divided for quite some time. And in a curious way, there was only this period, brief period, after 9/11 when there was a kind of coming together. And I don't mean it in the Bruce Springsteen, you know, anthemic, the come on up for the rising sense. It was just the sense of, Jesus, we're under attack. And the president says, we have to do this. And they said, yes. And we have to give away our rights for some security bills. And they gave away, you know, their rights to Homeland Security. And the president says, we have to go into Iraq. And now there's a lot of buyer's remorse about that. And the country is returned to being divided. Partially, it's divided from above because the Republicans, as an ideology, have seen non-cooperation in Washington with the Democrats as the way to advance towards some kind of conservative dream world. But at the grassroots level, the country really is divided because on the coasts, you know, in places like New York and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and San Francisco and West Los Angeles and in Seattle, places where people listen to Monocle Radio, by and large, the economy...
They're all good places.
...are probably doing better than other places. But in the middle of the country, where Donald Trump has been getting a lot of support, much to the world's amazement, and Ted Cruz has been getting almost as much support, much to the rest of America's amazement, that has not happened, and it hasn't happened for 20, 30, almost 40 years since the era of deindustrialization began in the mid-70s. And their mindsets are entirely different than those of the people on the coast. And so the country really is split socially, economically, and politically.
But James, the interesting thing is it's not just a coalescing around two different kind of poles of thought. It's a division within each of the parties about what they represent. It's amazing how on the Democratic side, so many people just do not like Hillary Clinton. They just cannot stand the woman. They think that she represents everything that's wrong about embedded politics. They feel that she kind of says what's needed. You know, even the spat over since the death of Nancy Reagan about her, you know, her coming to saying Nancy Reagan had been a good AIDS campaigner, then having to backtrack. You know, there's a lot of liberal people who do not like Hillary Clinton.
Well, let's be honest about this. There's a lot of people who don't like Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, it must be said, because they are seen to be far too moderate within the Democratic Party. Just as there's a lot of people in this country who don't like the Blairs because of the whole New Labour project, which is a replication of the New Democrat model, don't forget. With regard to Hillary Clinton, she is not, to use her quote, a natural politician. The natural politician of that family was her husband, who was, like him or not politically, one of the great politicians in American history, quite frankly. And she has managed to do very, very well by being Mrs. Bill Clinton. It's one of the things I talk about in my book that came out earlier in the year, the way in which she's managed to basically come along and use her relationship with her husband very, very skillfully to position herself as the potential first female president of the United States. But with regard to your formal point about, you know, the division within the country, Barack Obama comes to national prominence in 2004 with his keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention when he nominates Kerry, in which he famously says there's no red states, there's no blue states, there's only the United States. It's the most flawed statement by a leading politician in American recent history, because there is definitive red states and blue states. And the three of us could sit here now with two columns and say, well, these are red states, these are blue states, and we could divvy it up and be pretty darn accurate about how they're going to vote come November before a dime is spent on the general election.
And that's the other thing to consider here is that because, as I was explaining a while ago, on the coasts are pretty much Democratic territory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once we get past the nominating procedure, you get into the other vagary of the American political system, which is this concept of electoral college votes, where you are apportioned these electoral college votes by the size of your population. And because the populous states will go Democrat, whoever runs will probably only need to carry one swing state, and that state is Ohio. And Ohio, of course, is where John Kasich mm-hmm. is from. He's the governor. And what that means is that, you know, his ground operation there goes deeper than advertising can attack him. He runs the machinery. His people will be the people who set eligibility rules so that perhaps that I don't want to, you know, say that this will happen, but the African-American youth who's 18 and shows up at his local polling place can in some way be prevented from voting for Hillary Clinton, because he won't be voting for John Kasich. So Ohio could tilt that way, and then suddenly you've got a much more competitive race. But you would have to say that the Democrats start with an advantage for the White House. But everybody listening should remember that so long as the Republicans, as an ideology and an approach to politics, say, we will not cooperate with any Democratic president. They did their best not to cooperate with Bill Clinton. They have absolutely not cooperated with Obama. In a sense, they are as powerful as the president because they can prevent real serious, you know, Democratic policies becoming law.
James, we're going to bring in a slightly different point now, staying with the nominations. One of TV's top presenters in Russia on state TV has come out in favor of Trump. And meanwhile,
he'll be delighted.
Yeah, in China, the premier, Li Keqiang, has also said that he thinks that Trump's election will make no difference between relations between the US and China. This despite everything that Trump has been saying about China. Why do you think these big, tough nations think, actually, it makes no difference. We might even like Mr. Trump in the White House. Or are they just trying to annoy the Americans?
It's a distinct possibility, quite frankly. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, ultimately, the only people whose opinion matters are the American electorate. You know, you can be as popular or unpopular overseas as you like, but the only people who are going to count are the people who vote. You know, everybody's going to have an opinion upon this. I mean, the fact that we're here talking about this, you know, so long before the election is great for me, quite frankly. I love it. But, you know, Trump, if nothing else, gets, you know, an opinion wherever you are, quite frankly. And one of his actual selling points, one of the things that's propelled him to the top of the ticket like this is his notoriety and his celebrity. But he's only the latest incarnation of this. You know, you can look back through American history and think about Schwarzenegger, Jesse Ventura, to a slightly lesser degree, I think, Ronald Reagan. This idea of using celebrity to gain political office and bringing name recognition and not having to sort of sell yourself to be find out who the hell you are is of great importance. But the fact that, you know, the Chinese leadership individuals in Russia and elsewhere have got an opinion on Donald Trump, you know, will just be used by the Donald to sort of say, look, you know, here I am, I'm the big shot, you know, I've got big hands and everything else, and I'm going to be a big shot on the world stage. And it's more power to him, quite frankly.
Michael, there is an impression here, though, that, you know, the Russians, for example, may feel that, you know, that Barack Obama has just played by a rule book that they don't understand in a way, that he's been trying to, you know, do the right thing. He's worried about kind of what bringing along the Europeans and all other kind of constituents. If they got Trump in, it would be, they imagine, some kind of, like, you know, meeting by the fireside over vodka, you know, Trump and Putin, and they'd kind of knock out a deal together. Strongman politics. Do you think that in some capitals that is appealing? Is the notion that you don't kind of try and persuade a whole nation, you try and persuade one man?
Possibly. It's interesting, you know, all of Trump's comments about Putin, for example, in recent weeks have been extremely positive. Yeah. He's a strong man. I relate to that. I understand that. I understand why the Russians like him. And in a sense, contrasting him with President Obama, you know, Putin wants to do that. He sends troops into Syria when he's done his, you know, whatever. Now he's pulled them out. I wouldn't presume to know what Putin really, really thinks about the prospect of a President Trump. I will presume to say, because he's a former senior member of the KGB and has a deep feral intelligence about the West, that he has to understand how split American society is and how particularly Democratic presidents are hampered by a Congress which will continue to be, at least the lower house will absolutely still be in Republican hands after November. He'll be relishing that. He'll be relishing the idea that the American president goes into any negotiation with both hands tied behind his or her back, because they can't speak and they can't make agreements that can get past Congress when Congress is simply determined to make them fail.
James, you wanted to dive in.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, Michael sort of slightly beat me to it, but if any world leaders are so naive that they think that by bringing Donald Trump in, for example, they can just sit down and have a fireside chat and get things done, they're demonstrated a massive misunderstanding about how the US system works. The American president is empowered to go overseas and make agreements, but as Michael was rightly alluding to, they have to come home, and if you call it a treaty, get it through the Senate in that case, for example. And what we've seen so far over many years now is a steadfast refusal by the Senate, be of any political persuasion, quite frankly, to let a president go abroad and do that. They've been cut off at the knees repeatedly, going back at least as far as the 1990s, quite frankly. So if anybody's out there thinking that, hey, we can deal with the strongman Donald Trump and get things done mano a mano, they're mistaken.
Michael, today we've also seen the nomination by President Obama of Merrick Garland to be the next U.S. Supreme Court Justice. Is this a story that's even worth following? Because, you know, the Republicans have said quite clearly, we will not allow this to happen under our watch. It's not going to happen for a long, long time, is it?
No, it's going to get twisted in with this whole primary season, this whole political season, indeed. I mean, but when Antonin Scalia died in January, I guess, you know, before the news had a chance to go through one full cycle, the Senate Majority Leader, the Republican Mitch McConnell, said, no point in appointing a successor. The president gets to appoint the successor to any vacancy on the Supreme Court. No point in appointing, because we're not going to let you, you know. And in a sense, he fired all of his cannons at once. He could have at least waited to see what Obama did. Obama has come up with you know, a relatively relatively moderate and extremely qualified man for this position. He worked in the Justice Department as a prosecuting attorney and then as a judge, and came to prominence, such as it is, investigating the Oklahoma City bombings in 1993, or was it 1994? In 1995, this is when Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. Worst case of domestic terrorism in American history. And, you know, that's how he got noticed. In other respects, he's been on the federal bench in Washington, D.C., you know, first in his class in Harvard, undergraduate and in law school. Everything about him says, you know, and he's hardly a liberal. He's very centrist. So if we weren't living in these incredibly polarized political times, the fact that Obama's in the last year of his term would make no difference. I mean, Ronald Reagan in late 1987, when he had less than a year before his successor would be elected, made a nomination that was confirmed to the Supreme Court. Don't ask me who it was. I've completely forgotten.
We should bring James in here while we rack our brains. James, just quickly, Merrick Garland, on paper, actually, a pretty clever choice by Obama in some ways. As we said, you know, he's slightly on the progressive side, but he's not a kind of an out-and-out kind of, you know, anti-Republican candidate, is he?
No, far from it. Let's be honest about it. We're talking about, you know, someone who's on the bench. You know, you're not going to get that much of a radical, quite frankly. And Obama is not that much of a radical president. If you wanted to put someone forward, he was eminently certifiable, effectively, for want of a better word, then this is someone to put forward. And the Republicans have made a classic mistake, in my opinion, by saying, that's it, nothing. They are just portraying themselves as being obstructionist, problematic, and a roadblock to any movement forward. All they had to do was say, fine, put this guy forward and we'll consider him on the merits. They could have drawn out the hearings all through the summer and basically like kicked into the long grass. But by doing this, you know, Michael's beautiful turn of phrase, they fired off all their cannons at the same time. They have. And it was a foolish political move, in my opinion.
And then they wonder why people don't believe in politics or in Washington. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes. Coming up next, could Cyprus block the EU-Turkey deal on stemming the flow of migrants? Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, of course, are Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes. Now, the Cypriot president, Nikos Anastasiadis, has threatened to block a deal over the fate of refugees and migrants being decided between Turkey and the European Union. He says he won't agree to lift a veto on Turkey's EU membership talks unless it first fulfills its current obligations. Now, according to the president, they include recognition of the Cypriot government and opening up of Turkish ports and airports to passengers and trade. The Cypriot leader also issued the warning during a visit by the European Council President Donald Tusk to Nicosia. The island of Cyprus has been divided since the Turkish military invaded the north in 1974. Now, quite a lot of facts and figures to get heads around there, Michael. First, let's just cut to the chase. You know, is this a decent deal? Should the EU be kind of, you know, saying to Turkey, OK, you take back the migrants in this one-on-one deal and we'll kind of ease your way in. There feels to be some grubbiness around it, and many people are very unsure about it. And it's not just the Cypriots, although the Cypriots have, you know, many more kind of irons in this fire, as it were. They are just really voicing what many people feel, that this is a terrible, terrible deal.
Well, it is a terrible deal, and it's of questionable legality, and it's the worst kind of short-termism. And, you know, it's one thing, the EU is bad at dealing with crises, but this is one of a humanitarian nature and also one that involves war. There are many reasons to be leery of Turkey at this moment. I mean, the government is increasingly authoritarian. They've now, I mean, over the last few months, they've very publicly arrested journalists and editors and taken over newspapers that have been critical of the government. In the last 48 hours, they've started arresting academics who have, you know, shown some solidarity with the newspaper editors, including a British academic. This is not the time to really be considering Turkey's application on a fast track. I mean, 5 years ago, when the government of Turkey was not anywhere near this authoritarian, this was not a question. Turkey was, and had, by the way, was growing at 7 to 8% a year and was a huge export market for European manufactured goods. I just think that it all sounds wrong. But when you throw on top of it that extra level, the one and only time I've ever been to Cyprus was way back in 1996. Richard Holbrook, who had just successfully managed to bring an end to the Dayton to the Bosnian War, decided he was going to really cement his credentials for the Nobel Peace Prize and was going to solve the Turkey-Cyprus imbroglio, which was 21 years old at that point. It never happened. The anger on both sides is still too tight, and it is not something that I can see happening. And if you add into this the idea that, well, in order to get all these refugees out of our hair, we will fast track you and give you 3 billion euros and everything else, I can see why the Cypriot government is feeling particularly aggrieved, not to add in the fact that there's a lot of Russians who live in Cyprus now, who have homes in Cyprus. And you know that Russia and Turkey aren't getting on very well at the moment either.
James, it's an interesting point. Today, the Volkan Bozkir, who is the Turkish minister of the EU affairs, said that this is one country who's trying to hold up this whole deal. Meanwhile, as we've said, you know, the UN has said this deal is probably illegal and it shouldn't be allowed to go ahead. You know, where do you think, you know, what do you think is likely to happen? Because, you know, we're also hearing that, you know, other EU members saying, you know, Spain has already said it's not, it feels the deal is unworkable. Mm-hmm. And already in other capitals, we're seeing people say, there's something wrong here. We can't allow Turkey to be dictating so many of the demands here.
Yeah, I mean, your adjective was grubby, and who am I to argue with that, quite frankly? I mean, it's pretty darn accurate. You know, if you go back a couple of years when Turkish accession to the EU was being mooted quite powerfully, and as Michael pointed out, its economy was in a far better position. Even then, there were people who didn't want Turkey anywhere near the European Union for a whole variety of reasons. So if not then, why now? And if this idea of trying to shoehorn Turkey into the EU, just as the UK is trying to get out, it's hardly going to be particularly reflecting well upon the establishment as a whole. And when you've got the UN questioning the legality of this move, I think what you're seeing arguably is the fact that Cyprus are coming forward and at least give them credits, you know, calling a spade in this case. And the fact that now Spain is coming forward and other nations as well questioning this, I think you've got to say that whilst it's a very interesting academic exercise to talk about this, the likelihood is that Turkey isn't going to be a member of the EU anytime soon.
I mean, we've seen the elections in Germany at the weekend. Yeah. There feels, Michael, just finally, last few seconds, a kind of unravelling already of this deal around the edges, don't you think?
I think it is unravelling, and I'm not entirely sure it will ever be fully implemented. And that, too, would be very typical of the EU. They'll be back at the drawing board by June.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. because that is all we have time for on today's show, which was produced by Marcus Hippy. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Mari Giusti and also by Charlie Young. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's going to be lots more music next. And at 1900 hours, it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli, our show about how to run or start your own business. And we're going to have many more of the day's stories tonight on the Monocle Daily, and that's at 2200 hours here in London. Midori House, it will be back tomorrow at the same time. That's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.